There are other techniques to get your plotting motor going. By thinking of certain conventional obstacles, less conventional obstacles will occur to you. For instance, your character needs to get someplace right away. The car breaks down. In a melodrama, the breakdown may have been precipitated by the villain or an accomplice. Or the weather changes drastically and impedes progress. If the weather won't do, think of any unexpected, uncontrollable event. Here are some other stimuli. A deaf person fails to hear something. A blind person fails to see something. A recluse refuses to tell what he has seen. An airplane flight is aborted on takeoff. Water is needed immediately for an urgent purpose. Suddenly, there is no water in the tap. There are larger obstacles that can stimulate your plotting. A sudden illness of an important character. Help is unavailable. An accident happens on the highway to someone the reader cares about. Or an accident at home. Someone falls in the bathtub or off a ladder. A natural disaster, flood, earthquake, hurricane, forest fire, puts your character at great risk. It's common to think of the obstacles of all being generated by the villain, but we've seen that acts of nature can also be obstacles, and there are always other people butting in. You can devise an unwanted intervention by someone who wants to help but makes things worse, or you can have an unwanted intervention by someone unrelated to the villain who wants to block the protagonist for reasons of his own. You can have a previously absent person return who causes problems because she is not up on what has transpired during her absence. The list could go on, but you get the point. You can always check your daily newspaper for obstacles in the lives of people in news stories. One caution. Some obstacles need to be planted ahead of time so as not to seem arbitrary devices of the author. Writers who feel the need of discipline in plotting can sometimes benefit by preparing a list of every obstacle they plan to use in their plot. They then can ask themselves, is the first obstacle strong enough to hook the reader? Do the obstacles build? That means as each obstacle is faced and overcome by the protagonist, an even greater obstacle has to present itself. I know novelists who have very strong first obstacles, but they do not follow up with stronger obstacles, with the consequence that the reader feels the story winding down. As a result, the reader either gives up reading before the end, or, even if he's persistent, won't rush to get to that author's next book. Some writers I've worked with find it difficult to develop plots because they're not sure their plot ideas would be of interest to readers. Here are some clues to areas of reader interest. Reading about enemies trapped together. In life, one of the most uncomfortable experiences people have is being with someone they don't want to be with. In fiction, when readers observe someone else in that predicament, it engages a strong concealed emotion. The reader wants to know the outcome. Experiencing a character's embarrassment involves the reader. Causing a character to be embarrassed will almost always create an interesting plot development. Experiencing a character's fear creates enormous tension. It can be fear of mortal danger, of course, but experienced novelists generate fear from small things. Eric Ambler's The Light of Day has a scene in which the protagonist is chauffeuring a car with a loose door panel concealing smuggled arms. As the screws rattle, so does the reader, afraid that the car's owner in the back seat will hear the rattling. The scene is full of tension. Change in a relationship invites the reader's tense interest in the outcome. In life, people get bored when nothing changes, even though changes in life are fraught with peril. If the perils of major change happen within the covers of a book, the reader will be absorbed. Readers enjoy being surprised. Nice surprises are one of the pleasures of life. We like to receive surprise presents, good news, the announcement of an unexpected visit by friends we want to see. Bad surprises in life bring hurt, sadness, misfortune. But in books, readers thrill to the unexpected. A new obstacle, an unexpected confrontation by an enemy, or a sudden twist of circumstance all start adrenaline pumping and pages turning. Novels, stories, plays, and screenplays thrive on bad as well as good surprises. Surprises are not difficult to create. Look at each important incident in your plot and see what you would normally expect to happen next. Then have the exact opposite happen. At least half the time, an idea will suggest itself that will surprise your characters as well as yourself. You can surprise yourself and your readers eventually by picking an unusual locale that you know well enough to depict accurately. Then choose a character you have already created who is most unlikely to show up in that locale. Put that character in that locale. Imagine what happens when the character shows up there and other characters react. Finally, I would like to suggest an easy means for getting character-derived plot ideas. Sometimes even experienced writers get stuck. I counsel them to examine the classified personal ads, which frequently have the following characteristics. They are written by people who want a relationship so badly that they are willing to advertise for it. What they want is a mate, which is a high category of desire and the subject of much fiction. The ad writers are doing two things at once. They are trying to describe the kind of person they want to meet. They are describing themselves, sometimes unknowingly. The ad writers are frequently fantasizing about their ideal as well as about themselves. Readers of the ads usually get a far different impression from the one the advertiser intends. The personal ads I've seen that are useful appear in New York Magazine, The Village Voice, LA Reader, LA Weekly, and the New York Review of Books. Some are available nationally at better newsstands or by subscription. The New York Review of Books, a highbrow biweekly with a large international following, is a fine source because some of its ads are quite imaginative. I quote one of my favorites. Very unusual man. I'm looking for a very special woman, probably someone who rarely, if ever, answers ads. Very well educated and extraordinarily bright, funny, beautiful, athletic, sophisticated, outdoor-oriented, honest, nurturing, vulnerable, financially secure, very sensual, and able to be open and present to other people. Someone who is very successful in her own way, courageous and psychologically grown up, probably 35 to 45, with a great appetite for exploring life with another person. I'm extremely well educated, postdoctoral in humanities, and work at the top of the business community. Handsome, 6 foot, 180 pounds, athletic, very, very successful financially and professionally. I am a psychologically secure, well-balanced man who is totally natural and curious, sometimes brilliant, intuitive, funny, honest, genuine, direct, and very open. I spend 2 to 3 months a year off doing interesting things other than work. I am a very complex, very special man with deep values and a good heart. I need to find someone who has gotten to the same place in her life and is headed in the same direction. Note, phone, photo a must. I've read that ad at a number of writers' conferences. Invariably, the audience keeps laughing throughout. They laugh because of the discrepancy between their image of the advertiser and the person's self-image, ideal stuff for stories. If several writers were to choose the same ad as a source for a character-based plot, I can guarantee that they would come up with entirely different plots. Personal classified ads are a good emergency resource. In this chapter, we have covered the elementary essentials of devising a plot. Now let's take a look at some innovative ways of plotting. Chapter 7. The Actor's Studio Method for Developing Drama in Plots. A plot consists of scenes. What follows is an excellent way of creating almost any scene. In mid-20th century, the home away from home for most superbly talented American actors was a white wooden church on scruffy West 44th Street in New York City that had become the locus of the Actor's Studio. The building contained offices and rehearsal areas, but its core was the auditorium one flight up with its makeshift stage and hard seats. The physical environment didn't matter. All who entered there knew they were in the cathedral of American theater, where the most talented aspirants got a chance to be scourged by Cardinal Lee Strasberg, and where celebrated stars honed their work. In time, an associated directors group brought some of the best stage and film directors to work in the Actor's Studio. Missing were writers, the playwrights who needed to see their work in progress being performed by professional actors, guided by experienced directors, all willing to commit long hours of rehearsal and performance without compensation except for the arduous pleasure of work and the spurt of hope that once in a great while a scene coming to life at the actor's studio might turn into a production and a job. In 1957, along with Tennessee Williams, William Inge, Molly Kazan, and Robert Anderson, I was one of 10 founding members of the playwrights group of the Actors Studio in New York. As word of the group got around, it expanded to include talented newcomers like Edward Albee and Lorraine Hansberry, and novelists like Norman Mailer, who hoped to write for the theater. Writers could now see their new work performed by superlative actors, guided by talented directors. During its earliest years, the weekly meetings of the playwrights group included a trial performance of a play or a part of a play before an audience of fellow writers, directors, and actors, who would afterward comment on the work. Footnote. I deal with the sexual politics, outrageous experiments, glories, and shenanigans of this interesting group in a work in progress entitled Passing for Normal. Here, I concern myself solely with the technique playwrights learned that can be used to advantage by writers of fiction and film. For us writers, a high learning time came from the less formal exercises that did not require weeks of rehearsal by actors. In these exercises, writers were transformed into actors for the benefit of their colleagues. I was one of two writers picked by the director for an early exercise. The other writer was Rona Jaffe, the author of several best-selling novels. The director who worked with us that day was Elia Kazan, director of 5 Pulitzer Prize-winning plays and winner of 2 Academy Awards. For the writers in the audience, and for the victims, Rona Jaffe and me, it was an experience that gave us one of the most valuable techniques a writer can have. We were to improvise a scene for which there was no script. I was to play the part of the headmaster of the Dalton School, a private establishment in New York for the privileged young. Rona Jaffe was to be the mother of a boy who had been expelled by the headmaster. That's what the audience knew. Then Kazan took me aside, out of everyone's earshot, and told me that the mother of the expelled boy was coming to my office, undoubtedly to try to get the boy reinstated. This incorrigible boy had disrupted every class he was in, did not respond to the warnings of his teachers, and under no condition was I to take him back. After this briefing, which took half a minute, I returned to the makeshift stage, and Kazan then took Rona Jaffe aside. What do you think he told her? None of the writers, myself included, knew what Kazan told Rona Jaffe till afterward. He told her that she was the mother of a bright, well-behaved boy, a first-class student, that the headmaster was prejudiced against him, had treated him disgracefully, and that Rona had to insist that the headmaster take the boy back into the school immediately. Rona Jaffe and I were turned loose on the stage to improvise a scene in front of the audience. Within seconds, we were quarreling, our voices raised. We both got red in the face and yelled at each other. The audience loved it. We were battling because each of us had been given a different script. That's what happens in life. Each of us enters into conversation with another person with a script that is different from the other person's script. The frequent result is disagreement and conflict, disagreeable in life and invaluable in writing, for conflict is the ingredient that makes action dramatic. When we get involved with other people, the chances of a clash are present even with people we love because we do not have the same scripts in our heads. And the tension is even greater when we are involved with an antagonist. You are now armed. The secret of creating conflict in scenes you write is to give your characters different scripts. Over the years, in teaching writers at the University of California and at writers' conferences and workshops, I have stage-managed an exercise involving members of the audience that enables these principles to be remembered. In teaching the Actor's Studio method of creating conflict, I ask for one male and one female volunteer. I take the male student around a corner, out of earshot, and tell him that he is to visit a woman he loves and tell her, "I got your message." No matter what she answers, he is to insist he got her message. I then take the female student out of earshot and tell her that a fellow she thinks is obnoxious is coming over. She didn't leave a message for him. She just wants the money. When both students come on stage in front of the group, the male student arrives at a make-believe door, knocks, is let in, and says, "I got your message." The woman, as instructed, answers, "What message? Did you bring the money?" The usual reaction is loud laughter from the audience. Whatever the man and woman then say, the audience enjoys their adversarial dialogue, each relying on a different script. That's what you do with your characters. Whatever scene they are in, give them different scripts, and you'll have conflict in the scene and an entertained reader or audience. This technique works well for scenes in both commercial and literary fiction, with the scripts in literary fiction differing more subtly. This craft technique contains a range of possibility for every kind of writing. Let's clarify this simple procedure. You are imagining a scene with two characters. Before you write the scene, make a note as to the script, or tack, keep it simple, of the first character and then of the second character. Make sure the scripts are different and at odds. Only you will be privy to the scripts of both characters. Let them play out the scene in front of you as you write. And if you have a third character in the scene, give that character a script different from the other two. A script in this exercise is not the actual lines of dialogue, only the intent of the character in that scene. Think of the character as getting instructions from you, the writer. It is important to keep the instructions brief. In the example devised by Ilya Kazan, my script consisted of knowing who I was to be, the headmaster of Dalton School, and that I had thrown out a badly behaved boy. Rona Jaffe's script was equally simple. The headmaster was in the wrong, and she was determined to get her marvelous boy reinstated. One of the values of using this method is that if Kazan had used two different writers for the exercise and given them the same scripts, the audience would have heard different extemporaneous dialogue, and perhaps the scene would have taken a different direction than it did with Rona Jaffe and me. If you gave those scripts to a dozen different writers, you'd get a dozen different stories. As an exercise, jot down the scripts of each of the characters in a given scene of any novel you may be reading. The writer probably wasn't thinking of the characters' positions as scripts. The actor's studio technique is a shortcut to the intuitive and learned process that experienced writers use in creating dramatic confrontations in stories and plays. It's a wonderful technique. Use it well. Chapter 8. The Crucible, A Key to Successful Plotting. In the previous chapter, we were privy to the actor's studio technique, giving your protagonist and antagonist different scripts and letting them tangle. While two characters can have different scripts throughout a book, the actor's studio technique is most valuable for planning individual scenes. For plotting an entire work, I especially like the use of a crucible. In ordinary parlance, a crucible refers to a vessel in which different ingredients are melded in white-hot heat. The word has come to mean a severe test, which leads us to its use in plotting fiction. Author James Frey refers to a crucible as the container that holds the characters together as things heat up. Characters caught in a crucible won't declare a truce and quit. They're in it till the end. The key to the crucible is that the motivation of the characters to continue opposing each other is greater than their motivation to run away. Or they can't run away because they are in a prison cell, a lifeboat, an army, or a family. The following examples are drawn from memorable fiction that most writers will have read. In Hemingway's The Old Man and the Sea, the man and the hooked fish are in a crucible. Neither will give up to the other. In Flaubert's Madame Bovary, Emma Bovary is married to a man she loathes. Divorce then was impossible. Her marriage is the crucible. In Nabokov's Lolita, Humbert is in love with a young woman who is still a child. For most of the book, Humbert and Lolita are in a crucible because she has nowhere else to go. When a third character, Quilty, provides an exit for her, the crucible cracks. A crucible is an environment, emotional or physical, that bonds two people. It can be a scene or a series of scenes, but more often the crucible is an entire book. The crucible is a relationship, often one influenced by locale. two prisoners in a cell are in a crucible because of where they are, and their confrontations are accelerated by the fact that they are thrust into the cell with different scripts. The Kiss of the Spider-Woman is an excellent example. In my novel, The Magician, the crucible is a high school. The villain, Stanley Urich, goes to the school, and so does the protagonist, Ed Jaffet. Neither is free to go elsewhere. The crux of the conflict between the two boys derives from Urich's role as leader of a gang that extorts protection money from the other students and Jaffet's refusal to pay. Both boys must continue in school and live in the same community. The school, and in a sense the community they live in, is their crucible. In The Best Revenge, Ben and Nick start out as archenemies. Ben is producing a play for Broadway that is in deep financial trouble. Nick is a gangster nouveau, a new-style moneylender whose terms are severe, but Ben has no choice except to borrow from Nick and involve him in the production of the play. They are locked in the crucible of the play Ben is producing and Nick is financing. Ben is forced into a relationship he cannot leave. Nor does Nick want to leave once he gets a taste of the excitement of being involved in theatrical production. Remember that the essence of a crucible is that the characters are drawn more to the crucible than to escaping from it. In the end, the enemies, Ben and Nick, become friends, their lives melded in the crucible. In his book, How to Write a Damn Good Novel, James Frey came up with some excellent examples of characters caught in a crucible. I have adapted them and added others for use by my students. All the people in a lifeboat are in a crucible. Business partners, one a workaholic, the other lazy, are in a crucible. A wife and husband, bonded together by marriage, love, and duty, remain in conflict until separated by death or divorce. Their crucible is marriage. A father and son in conflict are also bonded by a relationship that even death doesn't end. They can walk away from each other, but neither can get the other out of his memory. Their relationship, for better or worse, is for keeps. Some situations do not lend themselves to creating a crucible environment in fiction, but you'd be surprised how many do. Test the possibilities. If the locale you have chosen for a particular scene does not add the stress of a crucible, can you change the location of the scene, making it difficult for one of the participants to leave? Or is there anything you can add to the background of either or both characters that would link them in a crucible and thereby raise the stress of their relationship? Putting two characters in a crucible is an excellent way to proceed in plotting. Some writers, however, prefer to work with a similar concept, that of a closed environment, the locale where the action takes place. Here are some examples to illustrate the difference. An astronaut who gets deathly ill during a space mission is in a closed environment. The location is a crucible, but as yet there is no overwhelming relationship that keeps him there. He is caught in a capsule in outer space. Robinson Crusoe and Friday on an island are in a closed environment. While their isolation from the rest of the world is the most important fact of their lives, their relationship gradually dominates the reader's interest. In Moby Dick, Captain Ahab's ship, the Pequod, is a closed environment. The most interesting relationship is that of Ahab and the white whale. Therefore, it is not the ship that is the crucible, it is the vast ocean that contains both Ahab and the whale. In Jean-Paul Sartre's brilliant play, No Exit, which every writer should read, all four characters are in a closed environment, giving the play its dramatic intensity and its theme. Hell is other people. When devising a locale for a scene, it always pays to give a few moments' thought to the possibility of choosing a closed environment. It will invariably increase the tension of the scene. The ideal time to think of that locale is when you are first imagining your characters. What crucible might they be in? If you can find the right crucible, you will be on the way to a mesmerizing plot. Chapter 9. Suspense. Keeping the Reader Reading. Your predecessor, a storyteller of many centuries ago, recited his stories around a fire. If he failed to arouse his listener's anticipation and droned on, or if his audience guessed what happened next, they either fell asleep or killed him. You are lucky. If you fail to arouse your reader's interest, the worst that will happen is that you won't get published. However, if your goal is publication, whatever the nature of your story, please pay close attention to what follows, because suspense is the most essential ingredient of plotting. You can have a remarkable style and intriguing characters, but if your writing doesn't quickly arouse the reader's curiosity about what will happen, the reader will close the covers of your book without reading further. Suspense is achieved by arousing the reader's curiosity and keeping it aroused as long as possible. Readers aren't articulate about what keeps them reading a particular work. Some, impatient to find out what happens to the characters next, will say, "I can't put this book down," which means the reader's curiosity is greater than his need to do almost anything else. Suspense is strong glue between the reader and the writing. I remember my pleasure at getting a letter from Barnaby Conrad, founder of the Santa Barbara Writers Conference and author of many books, including the novel Matador. Conrad had just finished reading a novel of mine, which, he said, he had been unable to stop reading except once when he got up to micturate. The function of suspense is to put the reader in danger of an overfull bladder. Of all reviews of my novels, the line I remember best was in the New York Times. "If you bury yourself in a Saltzstein book while walking, you'll walk into a wall." That's the idea. Immerse the reader so deeply in the story that he'll let go of the book only when the real world intrudes. Suspense derives from the Latin word meaning to hang. Think of yourself as a hangman. You take your reader to the cliff's edge. There you hang your hero by his fingertips. You are not to behave like a compassionate human being. You are not a rescuer. Your job is to avoid rescuing the hero as long as possible. You leave him hanging. Hanging, of course, is an extreme situation from melodrama. Suspense can take many forms, some of them subtle. Suspense builds when the reader wants something to happen and it isn't happening yet, or something is happening and the reader wants it to stop now, and it doesn't. Suspense needles the reader with a feeling of anxious uncertainty. Here are examples of the kinds of situations that create suspense. A prospective danger to a character. An actual immediate danger to a character. An unwanted confrontation. A confrontation wanted by one character and not by the other. An old fear about to become a present reality. A life crisis that requires an immediate action. The writer's duty is to set up something that cries for a resolution and then to act irresponsibly, to dance away from the reader's problem, dealing with other things, prolonging and exacerbating the reader's desperate need for resolution. Therefore, don't eliminate the prospective danger to a character. Don't let the character overcome the immediate danger without facing an even greater danger. If your character is apprehensive about an unwanted confrontation, make sure you hold off that confrontation as long as possible. When an old fear is about to become a present reality, don't relieve the fear. Make the situation worse than the character anticipated. If a character's life crisis requires an immediate action, make certain that the action backfires. Prolong the crisis. The point, of course, is that you don't resolve the suspense you've aroused. Your duty is to be mean. You are giving the reader a thrill he yearns for in books and detests in life. You frustrate the reader's expectations. Let's look at some examples. Isaac Dinesen, a remarkable short story writer, began The Sailor Boy's Tale with a young sailor observing a bird caught high in the rigging, flapping its wings, turning its head from side to side, trying to get loose. The young sailor thinks, through his own experience of life, he had come to the conviction that in this world everyone must look after himself and expect no help from others. The reader wants the young sailor to climb the rigging to free the bird. That action is delayed by the young sailor's thoughts about the past. The delay causes tension in the reader. In the fourth paragraph, the boy is climbing up. The bird turns out to be a peregrine falcon, which has special meaning for the boy. But just as he frees the bird, the falcon hacks him on the thumb, drawing blood. The reader wanted the bird freed, and look what happened. The reader has to wonder what will happen now to the sailor boy, to the falcon, to the young sailor's notion that everyone must look after himself and expect no help from others. In other words, the reader's curiosity is thoroughly aroused by boy, bird, and theme, all in a few paragraphs of a short story that ends not many pages later. The novelist's job is even harder, for he must arouse the reader's curiosity enough to hold him for hundreds of pages. That means that suspense and tension must be constantly renewed. In popular or transient fiction, the author usually relies much more on plot than character to arouse suspense initially, as Frederick Forsyth does in The Day of the Jackal. Forsyth's ingenuity in creating suspense is worth noting. Based on an outline of the plot alone, more than 20 publishers turned down his first novel, The Day of the Jackal, I among them, because the plot was about an assassin out to kill General de Gaulle, who was already dead. However, when Forsyth unanimously rejected, wrote the actual novel, he skillfully held the reader with powerful negative suspense, the reader hoping that the assassin would be stopped before he could kill de Gaulle. In other words, the reader was forced to suspend disbelief for the sake of the plot, and he was made to do so by the author's technical skill in arousing suspense, not through character as much as through intended action that the reader wanted desperately to see stopped. The Day of the Jackal is worth studying for its use of suspense. One of the most common complaints heard from editors is that a novel sags in the middle. By sag, they mean the story loses its momentum, suspense flags. The reader no longer has his curiosity aroused about what will happen next. To prevent this problem from happening in the first place, you must understand the ideal organization of a novel and how each chapter can be made to contribute to the suspense of the whole. In speaking before writers' conferences, I demonstrate a method for achieving suspense throughout a book by summoning 8 or 10 volunteers up on stage. I ask each person to think of a location for a scene and to announce it to the audience. The likelihood is that we get a series of wildly unconnected places: the desert near Palm Springs, Chicago, Hong Kong, a cave in Virginia, an island off the west coast of Florida, and so on. The audience laughs, enjoying the wild hopping about in space. We enjoy the surprise of moving around to unexpected places. I organize where each person stands to get the most interesting mix of locations. Then I ask each person in turn to remind the audience where his or her scene is located. I then point out how suspense will work throughout a book consisting of those 8 or 10 different scenes. Let us say that the first scene takes place in the desert near Palm Springs. The scene will end with the hero in serious trouble in the desert. Do we then start the next scene or chapter in the desert with the hero? Absolutely not. We leave the reader in suspense and go to the next location, Chicago, where we see a scene with a different character, say, the hero's fiancée getting into trouble. We want to know the outcome of what happened to the hero in the desert, but our attention is now diverted to the heroine in Chicago. At the end of scene or chapter 2, we desperately want to know what the heroine in Chicago, who is in serious trouble, will do to extricate herself. We now have 2 lines of suspense going: what will happen to the hero in the desert at Palm Springs, and, most urgently, what will happen to the heroine in Chicago. We begin the third scene in either of 2 places. We can go on to a third location, Hong Kong, and leave the reader in suspense about both the hero and heroine, or we can go back to the desert and continue the story of the hero at Palm Springs, leaving the reader in suspense about the goings-on in Chicago. Of course, at the end of scene 3, the hero is facing an even greater obstacle than he did at the end of scene 1, and the reader is left hanging. And in scene 4, we go back to the heroine in Chicago, or to a third person in Hong Kong. The places don't need to be as far apart as Palm Springs and Chicago and Hong Kong. The entire novel can take place in Marshalltown, Iowa, with the first scene ending with a bank being held up and our hero, the bank manager, being tied up and gagged by the daring robber and shoved into the vault. The second scene can then be, say, in the bank manager's home, where his wife is preparing dinner and wondering why her husband, always on time, hasn't arrived home yet. The wife, nervous, cuts her hand badly. She tries to stop the bleeding but has difficulty tying a tourniquet with one hand. She runs to a neighbor's house. The neighbor isn't home. She gets in her car and drives to the next neighbor, who is quite a distance down the road, meanwhile getting blood all over the seat of the car. As she arrives at the second neighbor's yard, she passes out in the car. End of second scene. The reader is now concerned about the bank manager in the vault and even more about his wife. The third scene starts with a local roofer working on a building across the street from the bank. He is an observant fellow and has noticed people going into the bank, but no one coming out. It's none of his business, but his curiosity gets the better of him. He slings his hammer into the leather carryall around his waist, eases himself down from his perch on the roof, and trots over to the bank. He looks in and immediately realizes what is going on and is ready to back off and call the police when the lookout for the bank robber spots him and, thinking the hammer at his belt is a gun, fires at the roofer, hitting him and alerting the robbers in the bank. Phew! The reader is now concerned about three things. The bank manager in the vault, the bleeding wife passed out in a distant neighbor's yard, and the roofer lying shot in the street. All of these events are in the same town, but by starting each scene in a different location and focusing each on a different character, we now have three lines of suspense going at the same time. It helps to jot down the location of each of the scenes in your book to see if they can be arranged in an order that will take each scene to a location different from the one at the end of the preceding scene. It isn't necessary to do this with every scene in a book. I find that if you change location or character in a majority of instances, you can also, where appropriate, continue the action of a suspenseful scene in the following chapter. The plan should be followed to achieve the purpose of suspense, not to follow a rigid pattern. Many writers also find this exercise useful in imagining different locations, which always increases reader interest. Making a simple chart like the one that follows will be of help. On each line, note the location, different from the location of the preceding scene, if possible, the principal character in the scene, and, briefly, the action that takes place there. Be brief. Keep in mind that if there is no action, you don't really have a scene. Scene outline, location, character, action. List scenes 1 through 10. One of the frequent failings of novelists is the inclusion of material between scenes. This usually takes the form of a narrative summary of offstage happenings. By using the simple outline above, the temptation to include material between the scenes may diminish. Remember that a reader's interest is in the scenes, not the interstices between the scenes. When I have a group on stage, each representing a locale where a chapter takes place, I have the writers first hold hands in a circle, then drop their hands to indicate visually that transitions between scenes aren't needed. Those transitions almost always constitute the offstage parts that make a book sag. Today's reader is used to jump cutting. The next step requires discipline also. Look at your list of scenes and find the weakest one, where your own interest flags. If you eliminate your weakest scene, you will strengthen your book as a whole. It takes guts, but do it. If you've eliminated the weakest scene, you now have another scene that is weakest. If you've got the guts of a writer, you may now be able to eliminate the second weakest scene. It's an ideal way to strengthen a book. Remember, your intent is to build a publishable novel. You are not a scene preserver. It will help to keep in mind the difference between a scene and a chapter. A scene is a unit of writing, usually an integral incident with a beginning and an end that, in itself, is not isolatable as a story. It is visible to the reader or audience as an event that can be witnessed, almost always involving two or more characters, dialogue, and action in a single setting. A chapter is a part of a longer work that is set off with a number or a title. A chapter may have several scenes or scenelets. When each chapter of a novel, except the last, ends, the reader's interest should be aroused anew, thrusting him forward in the novel. The key is not to take the reader where he wants to go. To refresh our understanding, Let's look at that ideal architecture of a suspenseful novel in terms of chapters. Chapter 1. The chapter ends with a turn of events that leaves the reader in suspense. The reader wants to stay with the characters and action of that chapter. Chapter 2. The reader finds himself in another place and/or with a different character. The reader still wants to know what happens in Chapter 1. Chapter 2 ends with a turn of events that leaves the reader in suspense. The reader wants to know how Chapter 2 turns out. Two lines of suspense are operating. In Chapter 3, the reader finds himself in a continuation of the suspenseful events in Chapter 1. He is still in suspense about Chapter 2. By the end of Chapter 3, a new line of suspense has been created. Two lines of suspense are still operating. If you keep doing this with successive chapters, the reader will be kept continuously in suspense, and there will be no sag in the middle of the book or anywhere else. If you think this kind of architecture is crafty, you're right. It is an important part of designing a novel to influence the emotions of the reader. And, as we know, the emotions of the reader are affected by suspense more than by any other factor. If you want to group your scenes into chapters, here are some guidelines. Short chapters make a story seem to move faster. Normally, avoid chapters of fewer than 3 printed pages. They may not be long enough to engage the reader's emotions. Ideally, each chapter might end the way the movies used to end their weekly serials, with the hero or heroine in unresolved trouble. If you're not familiar with those serials, use a soap opera as a guideline, with the end of each episode making you want to see what happens next. One of the best ways of accustoming yourself to the idea of continuing suspense is to study novels that you have found difficult to put down. Pick up any well-known suspense or thriller writer's work and look at the chapter endings. You'll see how most of the time each chapter ends on a suspenseful note and throws the reader forward into the next chapter. The most experienced suspense writers start the next chapter somewhere else or with other characters. In literary novels, of course, the suspense is often more subtle. All forms of fiction have one thing in common. The chapter endings arouse the reader's curiosity about what will happen next. Your chapters are not cemented in place. You can reorganize them in any fashion that accelerates the suspense of the whole. Watch out for time shifts that would disturb the reader. Try to keep moving only forward in time until you've had a good deal of experience. A word of caution. In reorganizing the chapters in a book, it is crucial to avoid disimprovement. Whenever shifting locations, keep a copy of your present architecture, then play with rearranging the chapters in another order. You may find that what you will be putting into new places are parts of chapters or scenes within chapters. That's fine. If you change the sequence of chapters or scenes, you may also have to do some stitching at the seams. Obviously, this rewriting is much easier if you're in an early draft, and still easier if you're in the planning stage. I cannot overemphasize the importance of architectural suspense. It has been a major factor in the success of writers I have worked with. Mastering this technique can in itself improve the chances of a book's acceptance for publication. Chapter 10. The Adrenaline Pump, Creating Tension. Writers are troublemakers. A psychotherapist tries to relieve stress, strain, and pressure. Writers are not psychotherapists. Their job is to give readers stress, strain, and pressure. The fact is that readers who hate those things in life love them in fiction. Until a writer assimilates that fact, he will have difficulty in consciously creating sufficient moments in which the reader feels tension. Tension is the most frequent cause of psychological changes in the reader. The sudden stress causes the adrenal medulla to release a hormone into the bloodstream that stimulates the heart and increases the blood pressure, metabolic rate, and blood glucose concentration. The result is an adrenaline high that makes the reader feel excited. That excitement is what the reader lusts for. Like all excitement, it is endurable for brief bursts, which is one of the factors that distinguishes tension from suspense. Suspense can last over a long period, sometimes for an entire book. tension is felt in seconds or minutes. There are occasions in fiction when it lasts longer and begins to border on the unbearable. The best novels have respites in which the reader is allowed to relax so that the tension can ebb, but not for long. The word tension is derived from the Latin tendere, meaning to stretch. Tension is a stretching out. Think of stretching a rubber band more and more. If you stretch it too far, it will break. We experience moments of tension as seeming longer because we want the tension to end. Tension produces instantaneous anxiety, and the reader finds it delicious. The writer's job is to create tension consciously, and in my lectures I sometimes demonstrate how tension is created. Without warning, I will suddenly adopt a stern expression, point a finger at someone in the first row, and in a commanding voice demand, "You, get up out of your chair." For a moment, the person I've singled out doesn't know what to do. The audience is hushed, watching. I order, "Stand up." The person, face flushed, wonders why I am ordering him to stand. "Stand up," I repeat. The tension in the room is great as long as he disobeys. When the person finally stands up, the tension in the audience is broken. I quickly point out that the way to create tension is to cause friction, ordering "stand up," and to have the recipient of the order not stand up. The tension will continue only as long as the disobedience. Several times luck has been with me during this demonstration. I order a writer in the front row to stand up, and he remains frozen in his chair. Again, I order him to stand up. By this time, the rest of the audience is as tense as he is. I step off the stage and come physically closer to the writer. In the voice of a Marine drill instructor, I bellow the order to get up. The writer starts to stand, and before the tension can break, I shout, "Lie down on the floor!" Telling someone to stand is not necessarily unreasonable. Asking someone to lie down on the floor of an auditorium full of people seems unreasonable. That's when the tension in the audience breaks. People laugh. Others titter. Finally, the victim in the front row joins in. He doesn't have to lie down. The tension is over. Our instinct as human beings is to provide answers, to ease tension. As writers, our job is the opposite, to create tension and not dispel it immediately. In examining the manuscripts of hundreds of writers over the years, a common fault I've observed is that the writer creates a pressing problem for a character and then immediately relieves the pressure by resolving it. That's humane, but not a writer's function. His mission is to manipulate the emotions of the audience, and when it comes to moments of tension, to stretch them out as long as possible. A common way to create tension in a novel is to simply note a fact that is likely to chill any reader. The following is the opening sentence of a thriller I recommended earlier, The Day of the Jackal, by Frederick Forsyth. "It is cold at 6:40 in the morning on a March day in Paris, and seems even colder when a man is about to be executed by firing squad." Does the precise time convince you of the reality of what's taking place? Do you want to know who is being executed by firing squad? Do you want to know why he's being executed? So did millions of readers. That one sentence creates tension. I recounted the plot earlier. An assassin has been hired to kill General de Gaulle. The reader doesn't want de Gaulle to be killed. That creates negative suspense, wanting something not to happen, that lasts almost to the end of the novel. The tension of that first sentence is momentary. The main line of suspense is book-long. The most important moment of tension in a novel is its first use, which should be as close to the beginning of the book as possible. It puts the writer in charge of the reader's emotions. You might well say, "Wait a minute, Stein, isn't my job in the first few pages to create a living, breathing character that will interest the reader?" Yes, of course. The closer writing gets to literature, the more likely it is that what fastens us to the early pages is our interest in a character. And then, as soon as possible, the writer creates some moments of tension for that character. Here in outline are the kind of plot situations that provide opportunities to create tension. Dangerous work is involved. The place is post-war Bosnia. A likable demolitions specialist parks his 5-year-old daughter with a neighbor watching from a distance, and then, a prayer on his lips, goes about trying to dismantle an unexploded shell. The author describes what the man is doing in minute detail. The reader, aware of the man as a human being, aware also of the 5-year-old watching from a distance, feels tension mount with every turn of the screw. A deadline is nearing. Molly knows that at 6 o'clock the villain will return. At 4 o'clock the hero, Frank, has not yet arrived, and Molly, glancing at the time, is tense. So is the reader. At 5 o'clock Molly is beginning to panic. At 6:02, the reader's tension is extreme. At 6:01, Frank arrives, breathless. An unfortunate meeting occurs. The heroine is in a department store elevator. She presses the button for the 6th floor. The elevator stops on the 5th floor, and the dangerously neurotic man she jilted gets on. The reader becomes instantly tense. An opponent is trapped in a closed environment. The protagonist, who in his youth hunted vermin on a farm, is now 70 years old. He owns the only rifle in the neighborhood, where the citizens are terrified by a rumor that a diseased mountain lion has come down into the town and chased a woman into the basement of her house. The woman has locked herself in the boiler room, and the mountain lion is roaring outside its closed door. The elderly rifle owner is summoned to kill the lion. A younger man offers to take the rifle and go down the cellar stairs to the trapped lion. The old man gives the rifle to the younger man, but immediately sees that the younger man doesn't handle the firearm in an experienced way. He asks for it back and enters the house. At the head of the cellar stairs, he hears the lion below, but can't see the animal clearly, except for its eyes. The older man has a flashlight, but how is he to hold the rifle with one hand and the flashlight with the other? As he puts the flashlight down, the crazed lion bounds up the cellar steps. Well, we'll stop right there. What we've done is add one tense moment to another, piling up the degree of tension toward a climax. The temptation for the inexperienced writer is to have the older man go in and shoot the crazed animal right off. That makes short shrift of the tension. By adding the element of the younger volunteer and the flashlight, we add to the tension, stretching it out. Tension can be as valuable in literary fiction as in thrillers. The opening story in Ethan Cannon's collection of novellas, The Palace Thief, is called The Accountant. At the very beginning, the accountant narrator tells the reader that his crime was small. We then hear him tell the circumstances and details of his crime. Far into the story, when we are witnessing the crime, we don't want the accountant, whom we've gotten to like as a human being, despite his faults, to wreck his life by going forward with the crime. While he is in the process of committing it, the reader becomes extremely tense. As the accountant takes an object that doesn't belong to him, we want him to put it back. This isn't suspense because he told us at the outset that he committed the crime, but there are moments of high tension, stretched out. The reader keeps hoping that any second the accountant will stop the clock, change his mind, not go through with this stupid, unnecessary, trivial, bizarre crime, and yet he goes ahead with it, wrecking his life. The Accountant is a story worth reading for pleasure the first time and worth studying the second time. Relocating a sentence to increase tension is a valuable technique. The she, in the following, is a young woman who doesn't yet know that a boy she had made love to is dead. She meets several of his friends. Here's the original. Before I got your message, I thought we were going to meet over at Urich's like usual. He in trouble again? A fog of silence descended. Nobody looked at anybody else. Finally, Feeney said, "She doesn't know." I transposed one sentence and created 2 new paragraphs. Note the increase in tension, though no words have been changed. Before I got your message, I thought we were going to meet over at Urich's like usual. A fog of silence descended. Nobody looked at anybody else. He in trouble again? Finally, Feeney said, She doesn't know. One of the easiest ways to create tension is by means of dialogue. The best dialogue sparks with friction, generating tension in the reader as it does in life. In the next chapter, we'll see how that's done. Chapter 11. The Secrets of Good Dialogue. Success in writing dialogue is one of the most rewarding aspects of the writer's craft. By the time you finish reading this chapter, you should know more about dialogue than 90% of published writers. The fact is that the majority of writers write dialogue by instinct with little knowledge of the craft. I was lucky. Plays consist entirely of dialogue. Before I was a novelist, I was a playwright and had a chance to see my plays produced on and off Broadway in New York, at the National Theater in Washington, and in California. For many years, I lived in a world in which the currency was dialogue. In the autumn of 1989, I was invited to give a 12-week course on Dialogue for Writers at the University of California at Irvine. In the class, writers of fiction far outnumbered playwrights and screenwriters. When I returned east at the end of those 3 months, the Los Angeles Times reported that the students, some with many books to their credit but still learning, refused to let the course end. They met weekly, insisting that I come back. I did each winter, and many of those writers are still studying with me, perfecting their dialogue and other aspects of their fiction. Readers enjoy dialogue in stories and novels. Those same readers would hate reading court transcripts, even of dramatic confrontations. What makes dialogue interesting and so much actual talk boring? Talk is repetitive, full of rambling, incomplete or run-on sentences, and usually contains a lot of unnecessary words. Most answers contain echoes of the questions. Our speech is full of such echoes. Dialogue, contrary to popular view, is not a recording of actual speech. It is a semblance of speech, an invented language of exchanges that build in tempo or context toward climaxes. Some people mistakenly believe that all a writer has to do is turn on a tape recorder to capture dialogue. What he'd be capturing is the same boring speech patterns the poor court reporter has to record verbatim. Learning the new language of dialogue is as complex as learning any new language. However, there are some shortcuts. First, let's examine some of the advantages of dialogue. As you know from an earlier chapter, fiction consists of three elements: description, narrative summary, and immediate scene. The 20th century reader, influenced by a century of film and a half century of television, is used to seeing what's happening in front of his eyes, not hearing about events after the fact. That's why immediate scenes, on stage, visible to the eye, dominate today's fiction. Dialogue is always in immediate scene, which is one reason readers relish it. When talk is tough, combative, or adversarial, it can be as exciting as physical action. Listen to this exchange from an early episode of the television series NYPD Blue. The central character is a detective named Kelly. In court, he sees the murderer of an 8-year-old boy use legal technicalities to win a plea bargain. Kelly is enraged. The judge warns him, "We govern by law, not by your whim." Not bothering to conceal his contempt, Kelly counters, "Don't tell me how you govern. I work your streets. I clean up after how you govern. The way you govern stinks." Confrontational dialogue, whether in Shakespeare, a contemporary novel, or a policeman talking back to a judge in a TV drama, is immediate, creating a visual image of the speakers as it shoots adrenaline into our bloodstream. As the writer of fiction masters dialogue, he will be able to deal with characterization and plot simultaneously. Let's prove that by taking a hard look at just 4 lines of dialogue and what we can accomplish with them. First, some actual overheard conversation. She: How are you? He: How am I? Oh, I'm fine. How are you? She: And the family? He: The family is great. Everybody's well. It doesn't take much of this to bore a reader out of his skull. Let's change those lines somewhat. She: How are you? He, I suppose I'm okay. She, why, what's the matter? He, I guess you haven't heard. Those simple changes introduce suspense. The second line, I suppose I'm okay, doesn't sound like the character really is okay. The fourth line makes the reader want to know what happens next. Let's try another revision of those four lines. She, how are you? He, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't see you. She, is anything wrong? He, no, no, absolutely not, I just didn't see you. With that exchange, we know something is wrong and that the man is lying. We're beginning to get a sense of character. In life, speakers answer each other's questions. We compliment a speaker by saying he is direct. Dialogue, to the contrary, is indirect. The key word to understanding the nature of dialogue is that the best dialogue is oblique. Take another look at those first two lines. She, how are you? He, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't see you. He doesn't answer her question. He is not direct. His response is oblique. The writers I've coached who learn how to make their dialogue oblique have all taken a giant step toward improving their work. Let's try one more revision. She, how are you? I said, how are you? He, I heard you the first time. She, I only wanted to know how you were. He, how the hell do you think I am? Characters don't need to make speeches at each other. From just four lines, the reader learns that these two people have probably had a relationship in the past that is not resolved, and at least for one of them, the relationship is filled with bitterness. We're not only characterizing, we're building a story out of just four lines. A reader's emotions can be sparked with few words. That's the power of dialogue. Tension can now be increased not only by the substance of the relationship, but also by incidental matters. For instance, he, it's beginning to rain. She, what do you suggest? The conversation can now go in a number of directions. He can say, why don't we talk some other time? Or, why don't we go in for a cup of coffee? Or, come sit in my car for a few minutes. Each of these would take the plot in a different direction. We've come a long way from the original boring four lines. If you need proof that dialogue and spoken words are not the same, go to a supermarket, eavesdrop. Much of what you'll hear in the aisles sounds like idiot talk. People won't buy your novel to hear idiot talk. They get that free from relatives, friends, and at the supermarket. What is the most frequently used word in real speech? It's what people say to borrow time to think of what they want to say. Is totally useless to a writer. Dialogue is a lean language in which every word counts. Count for what? To characterize, to move the story along, to have an impact on the reader's emotions. Some writers make the mistake of thinking that dialogue is overheard. Wrong. Dialogue is invented, and the writer is the inventor. Elmore Leonard is considered a superb practitioner of dialogue. But does anyone in life talk the way his characters do? Elmore Leonard's dialogue is invented. It is a semblance of speech that has the effect of actual speech, which is what his readers prize. If you're relatively new to dialogue, you might try an exercise I've developed that is used by screenwriters as well as novelists. Let's imagine two characters, Joe and Ed. Joe says, Ed? What is Joe trying to accomplish by that one word? There are several possibilities. Joe wants to get Ed's attention. Joe has heard somebody and wants to know if it is Ed. Now imagine that Joe adds one word and says, now Ed. What is Joe's intention? If there were a comma between now and Ed, it might mean the time is now, Ed. But there isn't a comma or pause. There are a couple of possibilities. Now Ed is a reproof. It's a warning. We don't know which unless we know the context in which the two words are spoken, but what is clear is that those two words in context can mean a lot, an admonition or a warning. Let's try one more. What does Joe mean by repeating Ed's name three times? Ed, Ed, Ed. If a dozen readers were to pronounce those three recitations of Ed's name, you'd probably get a dozen different intonations, but only one meaning. Joe's feeling of disappointment in Ed's conduct, derived from one word repeated three times. Ed, Ed, Ed.